emotional consequences of gun violence.
Using a single blood test to uncover undiagnosed diabetes.
How should we manage people who have had a non-fatal opioid overdose?
And maybe screening for an abdominal aortic aneurysm isn't beneficial.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This will be posted on June 22nd, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. Elizabeth, before we start recording, last week I was a visiting professor at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, and I was invited because the graduating chief residents have been listening to our podcast since we were students, and they actually wanted to meet the person behind the voice. So I want to give a special shout out to Harsha, Mohita, Naseem, Jessica, and Taylor, who all finished their chief residency and are headed off to either a hospitalist job in North Carolina or fellowships around the country. I had a delightful time. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, that is so great. Well, we're also, since we're shouting out, we're going to shout out to Tom, our longtime amazing partner in this endeavor, who's in Canada. He's a veterinarian. And he shared with me, based on last week's podcast, that nuts are an important part of his diet. And in fact, around his institution, there's lots and lots of signage relative to diet and heart health and nuts to your heart and so forth. Very clever. So I want to thank Tom for sharing that.
All right, Elizabeth, well, where do you want to go?
Well, let's go to something a little more sobering, I'm afraid. We're going to be spending some time in Annals of Internal Medicine this week. Three of our studies are originating there. One that I seem to spend an awful lot of time talking about is about opioid overdose. And what this study took a look at was, okay, if we are able to reverse somebody's opioid overdose with naloxone, which of course we're really happy that that's the case and many people have that experience, it's a good thing. Then what should we do after that? And what is the state of treatment and management? This study took a look at both buprenorphine and methadone after non-fatal overdose and found that those two drugs were associated with a 40 to 60% reduction in all-cause and opioid-related mortality. We know that people who have had one opioid overdose, of course, often experience a second one. And in fact, there's all this energy out there right now around, should we actually charge these people if they keep on coming back and having to be reversed, which I think is pretty crazy. So they took a look at this in almost 18,000 opioid overdose survivors. Of those two drugs, the methadone was better than the buprenorphine, and they didn't find an association between naltrexone use and all-cause mortality or opioid-related mortality. This issue of how to manage people who survive opioid overdose is incredibly important, and so I, at least, am very happy about this study.
There's some concern about people that have had a non-fatal opioid overdose that giving these medications for treatment may actually not help them because they may continue to use opioids despite these and it can contribute to their increased mortality. And what these studies show is it actually decreases their mortality. The disappointing thing about it is of the almost 18,000 patients, only 30% actually receive treatment. That means that we have a large opportunity when person presents to the emergency department to intervene at that time to get them on a treatment that can help them. The other thing that was really disappointing about the results of this study is that in these individuals that had opioid overdose, still over the next 6 months, approximately a third of them received another prescription for opioids, and about 26% received a prescription for benzodiazepine. So despite the fact they've had a non-fatal overdose, still a prescribing provider gave them additional medications that could cause them to have a second overdose. So that was disappointing. But overall, as you said, treatment is beneficial in preventing opioid mortality after a non-fatal opioid overdose.
I think this is especially important for our ED colleagues because that's where this interaction with the healthcare system takes place. And sure, I think it's really wonderful to refer people into comprehensive treatment that includes some kind of a prescription med to help them to deal with their symptomatology, but we have to initiate this in the ED.
Here's the trouble with that. To prescribe these medications long-term, a provider has to be trained and actually receive certification. And the emergency room physicians don't have that training and certification. So what we need to do is we need to have healthcare programs that transition the patient from the emergency department directly into treatment in a certified provider.
And those are barriers that, of course, are well worth both identifying and addressing.
Yes.
Let's turn from here to another in analysis I already said. Can we take just a single blood test in order to diagnose diabetes?
Currently, to diagnose diabetes, a person has to have one of three tests, an elevated hemoglobin A1C, an elevated sugar, or they have to have an elevated sugar after they've received oral glucose, called a postprandial glucose testing. And then once one of those tests is abnormal, it's recommended that over the next several months it be repeated to make sure it wasn't a false positive. That's problematic. It takes additional time for the person. It's additional expense. And so it's possible that a person can have a blood test that's abnormal and not have the follow-up and subsequently develop diabetes. So the question is, can we do it with just a single blood test? The investigators were able to examine this based upon a long-standing study called the ERIC study, the Atherosclerosis Risk in Communities. They had over 13,000 individuals that had a blood test done. They followed them up for the next several decades. In that group, almost 1,000 of them had an elevated hemoglobin A1C or an elevated glucose. And of those, about 40%, they were both elevated. The positive predictive value of having both of those tests elevated in that single sample was about 90% over 15 years. These people didn't have to come back for a second test. It just said these people are at very high risk and a very high likelihood of developing diabetes over the next 15 years. We need to begin those lifestyle interventions to try to either prevent that or delay that or to minimize their risk. That's the value of having a single blood test that may help predict diabetes.
I get that. On the other hand, I'm just wondering how much resistance we're going to encounter on the part of patients when they get told, hey, you know what? You're at risk for diabetes. We really need to institute all of these things, and we're basing that on a single measurement.
I'd feel differently if the measurement didn't have such a great positive predictive value. If you can tell someone, listen, there's a 90% chance over the next 15 years you're going to develop diabetes, I think that's important information that someone has to have. I think it's a great starting point.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how it manifests in clinical practice.
You know, sometimes you only have a one shot at seeing a patient, and they don't come back. And so to be able to provide that information when you see them can be very important.
Planting the seed. Let's turn to our third from Annals. That's survivors of gun crimes and just how emotionally impactful that is. And I'm actually really happy to see this study because there's been the federal prohibition, of course, against the funding of studies relative to guns. And so this is a really great way to kind of provide some data that could be really useful in this debate. What they did is they took a look at firearms involved in over 250,000 victimizations in 2015. If a gun was used in this particular event, what was the long-term emotional impact of that? They basically found that anyone who was involved in an event where a gun was involved, 39%, reported feeling severe distress as a result of that. People who were victimized with different weapons, that was 31%, and with no weapons at all, 24%. So clearly, when firearms are involved, there's a greater likelihood of severe distress as a result of having this experience.
These were all individuals that had been victimized in some way, but a small portion with guns. There's something about having a firearm involved that increases the social distress. They weren't able to exactly pin what that is due to, but the most important thing, as you said, is we're not going to be able to address this issue as long as we bury our head in the sand and don't do studies looking at firearms and their societal effects and what we can do to decrease firearm victimization. Prohibiting funding of studies isn't going to help us as a society. The reason they were able to do it is they used a National Crime Victimization Survey. It didn't require federal funds.
That's about as much as we need to say about that. We need more. Let's turn to your final one in The Lancet. Rick, we actually advocated just a few years ago for screening for abdominal aortic aneurysm, especially in men and those with a history of smoking. Now this study seems to be refuting that recommendation.
Previous studies have shown that if you screen for abdominal aortic aneurysm, you can decrease the mortality associated with it. Along comes a study from Sweden where they looked at data from men over the age of 65 who had been screened and compared them to a group of men who weren't screened. There really wasn't a significant benefit for screening. So what's changed? The major thing in Sweden is that there are fewer men that have an abdominal aortic aneurysm, primarily because the smoking incidence has gone down from about 40% to 15%.
Maybe the stratagem is to just screen in men who are smokers.
And that's the recommendation in the United States. Let's pick the high-risk individuals. Now, this study didn't address that. This is a screening in all men over the age of 65. But my personal opinion is I think you're right. I think you limit it to the high-risk individuals because that's what the previous studies showed received the most benefit. So I think you hit the nail on the head, Elizabeth.
We love that evidence base, don't we? On that note, I'm going to talk about the drug treatment following near misses with opioid overdose on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. If you're from Baylor College of Medicine or anywhere across the world, y'all listen up and make healthy choices.